If you could please take your seats, we'll go ahead and get started with our next lecture so we can stay as close to schedule as we possibly can. Before I do that, I want to thank Estelle again for an excellent presentation and just mention that we, again, do have portrait tours here at the Filson, and if you're interested in the schedule and the timing, you can talk to Joe Folsom over here or check at the front desk. So I think everyone's just about found a place to sit down. So without further ado, I will introduce John T. Edge, director of Southern Foodways Alliance at the University of Mississippi. His lecture is entitled Rolled Oysters, Bison Barbecue, and Lunch Counters. Our Foodways Ourselves. John Edge holds a Master of Arts in Southern Studies from the University of Mississippi and a Master of Fine Arts in Creative Nonfiction from Goucher College. He has written or edited more than a dozen books, including the Foodways volume in the New Encyclopedia of Southern Culture. And I hope you'll get a copy of that. In addition to his books, he writes about the foodways of the American South for the New York Times. He is a contributing editor at Garden and Gun, and a longtime columnist for the Oxford American. So please join me in welcoming John Edge to the Filson. John.
I'm happy to be here less than happy to follow what was a great presentation. So I hope you'll bear with me as I try to tell you some stories about food culture in this modern moment. As you can see, we have a screen up, and we'll close with a film. So if you find me terribly boring, and I hope you don't, I can at least promise you a film. No popcorn, but lunch follows soon after. So, as mentioned, I direct the Southern Foodways Alliance at the university. It's an institute of the Center for the Study of Southern Culture there at the university, which is the editor of, the sponsor of this volume of encyclopedias. The Southern Foodways Alliance documents and studies and celebrates the diverse food cultures of the South. We set a common table where black and white, rich and poor, all who gather may consider our history and our future in a spirit of reconciliation. I think about Dr. Pennington's remarks and about the complexities of our region, and it's something that we seek to examine as well. And I think food is a good entree to thinking about those issues. Today I want to talk to you about how I might apply the approaches that we've developed at the SFA to a study of Louisville, to thinking about foodways in Kentucky and specifically in Louisville. At the conclusion of this talk, I'm going to tell you two stories kind of about the modern moment in Louisville, and one of those will involve this film I mentioned. Now, to get myself primed for this talk and for this visit, I got to town a little bit early yesterday, and I ate a burger at Ollie's Trolley. And obviously, by way of the response, I don't need to tell Louisville folk what Ollie's is, but for some of our visitors, it might be appropriate. It's a remnant of a short-lived burger chain built around the personality of a guy named Ollie Glickenhaus. He was a grease jockey from Miami Beach whose story was told by Kentuckian John Y. Brown in the same manner that he sold America on Colonel Sanders. This was going to be the general to the colonel, is the way Mr. Brown talked about him. And that's an interesting part to me of Louisville history, is the merchandising, the selling of food to America. And Mr. Glickenhaus and that burger, it's a great remnant of that. Last night, after a great dinner at Milkwood, which I'll talk about later, I went to the Mag Bar around the corner with Chef Edward Lee. We sat and talked and had a bourbon or two. And I thought about another time when I'd been in Louisville, and there was a downtown bar that went to a number of times with friends called Jake's Club Reno. Anybody remember this bar? It was a real dive. The bar is gone, and I believe Jake is too now. But I remember him on my last visit. He was 84 at that time, kind of leaning into the bar with a bottle of Old Granddad, kind of pouring from his shoulder, as if he'd just torn his rotator cuff. on his last Manhattan. And he said, without affectation, with a genuine celebration of his labors, he said, "Jake's the name, whiskey's the game." This is all to say I've spent a good bit of time in Louisville through the years. Ronnie Lundy, who was the editor of Louisville Magazine for a while, began her career writing about Newgrass and the Bluegrass Revival, moved on to food. Ronnie was my guide to a lot of the city. And over the years, I've spent time with people like Lewis Shuckman of Shuckman Smoked Fish here, the fastest talking Southerner I know. You know, if you think we're all molasses mouths, meet Lewis. I've played Dainty, the stickball game, in Schnitzelburg, and missed incredibly. If you don't know Dainty, it's a stickball game where you somehow project up into the air this little piece of wood, and you're supposed to hit that little piece of wood with an even smaller bat. And it's a game of German neighborhoods and bar culture in Louisville. I enjoyed that time. I've spent time at the Pendennis Club here with Julian Van Winkle drinking his product and enjoyed it very much. And I've sat with and stood with Matt Jamie of Bourbon Barrel Foods here as he creates, a great example of a 21st century Louisville product, the Bourbon Barrel aged soy sauce, with soybeans grown in Kentucky. Using old bourbon barrels as the aging mechanism, as the aging vessel. A great example for me of what Louisville looks like for an outsider like myself in this moment. I've also eaten oyster rolls at Mazzoni's back when it was open, back when Greg was behind the bar. And more recently, I've eaten oyster rolls, strangely, with Wendell Berry and drank scotch with him, which I always thought was, the man who's championed local foods and local agriculture, when Michael Pollan was still in knee pants. The idea that, I'm sitting there eating oyster rolls, which ain't from around here. Maybe the preparation's from here, but, the mollusk itself. And drinking scotch, not bourbon. I found that a great example of how he's a complicated man. Along the way, I visited with Marvin Finn when I was here back in the 80s. And I really want to get to this afternoon, before the sun goes down, out to the flock of Finns here. But I love his folk art. Forgive me, oh my Lord. I did say that, didn't I?
It'll take you a while.
But I admire his work, Mr. Finn's work, and we've got a... about a 5-foot rooster of Mr. Finn's in our home. All of which to say is that I'm a student of Louisville. Its ways, its mores, its people. And if you asked me to tell food stories about Louisville that matter, I'd tell you a couple that I think matter to me. I could talk about female entrepreneurship by leading a discussion on Benedictine spread and its creator, Jenny Benedict. Everyone in this room has had Benedictine spread, correct? Who has not? See, you won't even, yeah. Okay, Ted, all right. But, that spread, emblematic of this place, is a great way to think about and talk about female entrepreneurship. It's not just cream cheese and cucumber. Born at Harrods Creek, Kentucky in 1830, Jenny Benedict founded her Louisville catering company in 1893, working from a small kitchen behind her house. To announce the opening of her business, she printed 500 flyers offering to take orders from a cup of chocolate to a large wedding reception. Sandwiches on order, cakes large or small, trays and dainty dishes for the invalid. Though Benedictine spread was not among the original offerings, in later years, while operating a tea room, it would win her such acclaim that after catering a St. Louis wedding reception, just before World War I, the Missouri City, that being Kansas City, is reputed to have offered her a guarantee of $1 million in business should she choose to relocate. The good folks of Louisville raised such a hue and cry and such a cache of money, at the thought of losing dear Miss Jenny, that she resolved to stay put, declaring, "So great was the pressure brought to bear that I promptly abandoned the thought of even considering such a move." She stayed put in Louisville. We could take another tack. We could think about, is there a way for that not to be that? Yeah, I think it does. If we can keep it from cycling, we'll try. I'm not endorsing the LCD multimedia projector. There's another tack I could take. I could talk about civic life in the South, and Louisville is an example of that. You know, from my perspective, and again, I'm a Georgia native with South Carolina parents, now living in Mississippi for almost 20 years. From my perspective, I see Louisville as a city of clubs. Perhaps, you know, it's attributable to the city's long status as an industrial and commercial center. Maybe it's a vestige of the day when newly arrived immigrants of like countries gathered on weekends to sing songs of their homeland or savor the foods of their youth. But over the few years I've come here, I've noticed, example, a few years back, we at the Southern Foodways Alliance staged our summer symposium here in Louisville to explore the food culture of the city. And we staged an event, a fish fry, at the All Wool and Yard Wide Democratic Club. And I didn't bring my card, but I joined that day. You know, I thought about that tradition of a fish fry and how much it resonates in Louisville. That next Saturday, I was still in town, I went out to the suburban Masonic Lodge. You know, and y'all know this place, you know, from the 1920s onward, men have been holding a Saturday afternoon fish fry that draws devotees throughout the region. Set in a neighborhood that was once popular with families of railroad men who earned a living working the L&N. So when we're thinking about food, you know, we've begun talking about labor, about civic life. And again, I come back when I think about that suburban fish fry on Saturdays. I think, too, about this notion of local foods and what's local and what's not. Mr. Berry's rolled oysters and scotch, local to him. That fried cod, which came probably from Alaska, you know, fried and served by the Masonic Lodge, claimed by folks of Louisville and especially by people in that neighborhood, is very hyper-local. There's a process in which foods that are from off are claimed by the folk here, and that interests me a great deal. Now, when I talk and think about food, I think we can use food to tell stories and to get a number of points across. And those points for me include that food is an essential to life. It's arguably our nation's biggest industry now. Food, too much, not enough, the wrong kind, the wrong frequency, may now be our society's greatest cause of disease and death, too. And yet, those of us who see meaning in food culture, who recognize that the import of food is not merely measured in calorie counts and nutrition payloads, often labor under this kind of burden of pleasure, this idea that food is not serious-minded stuff. And yet, when we think about food's role, its essentialness to life, and the positive effect it has upon our countenance when we eat, the negative effect it has upon our bodies if we eat too much or the wrong kind, there's depth there. You know, and I think that dismissal of food studies has something to do with the fact that, say, because country ham hung in a smokehouse until it achieves that crystalline moment of readiness during the summer sweats after emerging from a smokehouse, because that is a guilty pleasure on some level. Because a food like pawpaws pulled ripe from trees sagging with fruit are so delicious they're almost randy. You forget that word, right? You know? And what it means. Thanks for allowing me to use it. And there are other reasons, too, that food is often relegated to a matter of less than importance. because this may be the most vexing part, too. Many of the cooks who have long worked with these goods to craft great meals have historically, in the South, been black, or have historically been women. We don't often deem food worthy of intellectual inquiry because it is saddled with, and it is linked to the labor of black men and women and women in general. On that subject, the French sociologist Jean-Henri Fabre said that history celebrates the battlefields whereon we meet our death, but scorns to speak of the plowed fields whereby we thrive. It knows the names of the king's bastards, but cannot tell us the origin of wheat. That is the way of human folly. So, what is food? How do we think about it? How do we study it? I think about food as a social artifact, a pattern of cultural interactions worthy of observation. Food offers us a non-threatening way to get at big issues like race and class and gender. And I think much of the good work now being done in the broad world of food studies focuses on matters of health and food supply. I did an interview with the Louisville Courier Journal, and the gentleman who asked questions asked great questions. And one of the things we started talking about was this moment when in American culture now we realize and recognize the import of agriculture in our lives, and we many more of us patronize farmers markets. We see the value there, and yet we're oftentimes not thinking about in such depth the people who grow that food, the people who serve that food, the people who serve us. And that's a lot of what the Southern Foodways Alliance attempts to do through oral history work, through film work, to tell the story of the South through food as a cultural product and the people who drive that. So that's in large part what the Southern Foodways Alliance attempts to do, to talk about the human resources, the people on which our food systems and our totemic dishes depend. Food, like literature, like art, like music, is a product of people and place. Compared to art and literature and music, it's mundane, right? It's every day. That is its power, to my mind. It's food is the art of the people. We all make it and we all consume it. Food tells us stories, stories that enrich our lives, which is what the humanities seek to do in the first place. Now, to make my point, I'd like to read a brief passage which I lifted from the encyclopedia volume, the Foodways Encyclopedia volume. It's ostensibly about pork and corn, kind of bedrocks of Southern culture and Southern culinary culture. And if you buy my argument of just a few moments ago, it's about more, though. We can read lots into pork and corn. So, here we go. I'm deeply honored to stand before you and talk about this volume. I first came to the University of Mississippi, moved to Oxford, when as a undergraduate heading back down the path to righteousness after a long time out in the forest. I went back to school to get an undergraduate degree in Southern Studies and then went on to get a master's degree in Southern Studies. And like many people who arrived at the Center for the Study of Southern Culture in that period, I was inspired by the first edition of the Encyclopedia of Southern Culture. This notion of opening up that big volume and seeing my people and my people done right inspired me. So to step before you today and have been a part of the second edition of that encyclopedia, the new Encyclopedia of Southern Culture, fills me with great pride, and I'm happy to share with you a bit of it. And hopefully some of this will resonate. This is the point where I drink a little bit of water. For much of our region's history, working-class Southerners subsisted on the 3M diet. Those 3 M's, translated as meat, usually pork, meal, corn, and molasses. Sorghum in the northern reaches, usually. Cane in the southern reaches, usually. Of those three, pork and corn were the true bedrock ingredients of southern cookery. With cornmeal ground at nearby mill, southern cooks have long made cornbread the region's staff of life. known by various names: spider bread, pone, suppone, hot water cornbread, dog bread, cracklin', cornbread, hoe cake, and a dozen more colloquialisms. Cornbread is the most elemental of Southern foodstuffs. It serves as a totem of identity as well as a marker of, among other things, class. Folklorist and novelist Zora Neale Hurston made the latter case in her 1934 novel Jonah's Gourdvine, wherein a collaborator complains about, a character complains about returning across the river to a lower class existence. "Mom, I don't like to go way back over there in the woods. All you hear about over there is work, push hard, and pone bread. Cornbread with nothing on it, nothing in it but salt and water. I like it over here, where they talk about biscuit bread sometime." Journalist Bradford Huey also appreciated the importance of bread as a socioeconomic delineator. Quote, "Biscuit for bread is a social and economic self-measurement among croppers and hands," he wrote in 1942. Continuing, "People who eat biscuit for breakfast regard themselves as successful persons of dignity. They look down on the unfortunate who have to go back to corn pone during hard times. A Negro or white cropper who would relish corn pone for dinner or supper, but to have it for breakfast would have broken his spirit. Corn pone for breakfast among croppers is like a patch on the seat of the breeches of a man, or drawers made of flour sacks for women." Now, let's talk about pig. The Spanish introduced pigs to Florida, as y'all know, in 1539. Pigs foraged for food and were efficient converters of feed to flesh, while pastoral cattle proved to be more expensive to sustain. Pork came to be pervasive as part of the Southern diet that in 1860, John Wilson Jr., a Columbus, Georgia physician, observed that in many parts of the region, so far as meat is concerned, it is fat bacon bacon, fat back and bacon, and that continually, morning, noon, and night, for all classes, sexes, ages, and conditions. And except the boiled bacon and collards at dinner, the meat is generally fried and thus supersaturated with grease in the form of hog lard. It is the very oil that moves the machinery of life. Sounds like y'all have been well old before. Southerners embraced the hog as both a source of calories and a source of inspiration. Both symbolically and in reality, the hog has become ingrained in the culture of the South, argued Jonathan Bass. Much like cotton, the hog developed from a simple economic staple to a broad cultural symbol. John Shelton Reed, a great friend of the Center for the Study of Southern Culture and a great thinker about the sociology of the South and also the foodways of the South, has argued that barbecue joints are one of the few places in the South where you get all kinds of people. Black and white, bikers and lawyers, Christians and cowboys all appreciate good smoked pork. Further, Reed has argued that taking into account the divisiveness that surrounds certain symbols of the South, including certain flags that certain people fly, that he would consider proposing a new emblem for the South, a new flag that would have dancing pigs, much like you might source at a barbecue joint. When you think about the iconography of barbecue joint signs, there's an inclusiveness to them. And Mr. Reed would argue that once you saw that sign, you'd know you were in a Southern place. Now, musical expression also reflects regional foodways, and pork and corn included. And that is evident in a song like Uncle Dave Macon's 11-cent cotton, 40-cent meat. Hard times. Dan Penn's Memphis Women and Fried Chicken. Good times. Memphis Minnie's, "I'm selling my pork chops, but I'm giving my gravy away." We can talk about what that means later. Think about the traditional song, "Chitlin' Cookin' Time in Cheatham County." It gives voice to how and why chitlins matter. When it's chicken, let's see if I can get that. Chitlin' Cheatham. "When it's chitlin cooking time in Cheatham County, I'll be courting in them Cheatham County hills. And I'll pick a Cheatham County chitlin cooker. I've a longing that the chitlins will fill." Now, think about these passages I've read about pork and about corn. You know, I hinted that they offered us a way to think about creativity, certainly, in the last part, about race, about class, about gender. And I think there are a number of other ways. So I've gone from my observations of your Louisville to a bit of a history lesson about how you can read foodways and how I think that's appropriate. And I want to close with two stories about Louisville in this moment that I think are very interesting, taking into account the idea that this is a conference that looks at the 21st century South. And in many ways, as Charles set the tone, you know, Southern futures and how they might be imagined. And try to think about what two stories that could be told now about Louisville and about its food culture will have resonance a generation from now. And this is my crystal ball take on that. And I was thinking about this. I'm going this afternoon with a friend over to Ceviche, the Anthony Lamas-owned restaurant, you know, and to think about someone like Anthony who does, you know, empanadas with Kentucky bison and noodle soups with collard green pot liquor. You know, in it, you know, I think that is an honest reflection of his upbringing, of his Hispanic heritage, deeply enmeshed in this place, using local ingredients. And I think there's a story to tell there. I think that, you know, the South is, as we all know, and as Charles made the great point, you know, the South isn't fixed in some place past. Culture is progressive. Culture, you know, we are moving forward, whether people consider that a regression or not. You know, we are not fixed. The South, the ideas of the South are not fixed in some past. And I think what Anthony Lamas is doing is a great expression of foodways of the 21st century Louisville. Even better, I think, than Anthony, though, is Edward Lee, whose primary restaurant, 610 Magnolia, is just two blocks from here. A number of the speakers here gathered at his second restaurant, Milkwood, last night and had a great dinner that included collards and kimchi as a dish, that included a really beautiful, to the point of my talk, a really great bison barbecue that included these beautiful sunchokes, included a grits ice cream, which sounds like a complete goof and sounds like something you would, you know, that would raise the hackles of anyone who wants to set up binaries between the North and the South and say, that's what Yankees do to grits. They put sugar in them. Well, I'm telling you, like, if that's what Yankees do, we got something to learn from them, because the grits ice cream was fantastic. So I want to introduce you to Edward based on a conversation I had with him. Edward as, to me, an idea of a 21st century Southerner that matters and that will continue to matter as Louisville tells its story through food. Edward, born in Brooklyn, a native of Korean ancestry, first visited Louisville during Derby Week in 2002. Fresh from a series of kitchen stages in France, he was traveling across the U.S., eating his way toward an understanding of new American cuisine. Now, somewhere along the way, perhaps it was at Chez Panisse in California, maybe at the Inn at Little Washington in Virginia, he heard stories of a charming dowager restaurant tucked in a lush Victorian neighborhood, that would be here, south of downtown Louisville. That restaurant, 610 Magnolia, founded in 1979, was run by Eddie Garber, a chef who cultivated an eccentric personality and who, Edward told me by way of explanation, he was the kind of chef who was known to keep a roasted duck on the bar and buy it glasses of champagne throughout the night. So I wonder if that's the reference to the duck that you had perhaps last night. So Edward Lee arrived beneath the beam ceiling of that former carriage house to eat and drink and observe. But halfway through the evening, taking note that the kitchen staff was deep in the weeds, Lee joined one of the cooks on the line. At the end of the night, Edward recalled that Garber called a brief meeting of chefs and waitstaff and introduced me curtly as, "Everyone, this is Edward. Just listen to whatever he tells you to do and do it." Such begins Edward's career in the South. The young chef did go back home to New York, but not for long. Shortly after Derby 2003, Lee, in league with business partner Brooke Smith, who through the years has become a great friend of mine, that Brooke and Edward made 610 Magnolia their own. Half the town was pulling for me, Edwards said, and half of them were waiting for me to screw it up. And some of what they were waiting for him to screw up, I would argue, is how he negotiated his southernness, how he negotiated the telling of Louisville's story through his restaurant. Now, he confounded traditionalists, I would argue. He ditched the Caesar salad, which was on that menu and was required of any Louisville restaurant aspiring to white tablecloth preeminence or, how would you put it, expense account preeminence. And he also refused to cloak himself in the kind of cloak of southern cookery. That got me some freedom, Edward told me. When I said I wasn't a southern chef, the locals allowed me enough rope and said, it's okay, he's not from here. And I got to say, here's my chess pie. Try it. It's kind of weird, but I think you'll like it. In the intervening years, Lee, who's now 40 and has a new baby child, has stocked his library with the likes of Wendell Berry, the poet and agricultural thinker, Camille Glenn, the Louisville-based author of The Heritage of Southern Cooking. It's like a glance through Edward's bookshelf tells you about his thought process. What's more, he's become an advocate of such Kentucky fare as Nancy Newsom's Country Ham and Pappy Van Winkle's Bourbon, about which I'll speak in a moment. He hasn't, though, wholly assimilated. Take, for example, the black barbecue sauce, which we had last night, in which Lee slathers on pork and bison. That sauce, you know, Lord help me, I'm going to say we're going to unpack that sauce, but that's what I'm going to say. It's a black barbecue sauce. So, if you're Edward Lee and you're a native of Korean ancestry, native of Brooklyn of Korean ancestry, living in Kentucky, there are a lot of things to work with there. One of the things he has to work with is mutton dip from the western ranges of your great state, that kind of black dip for mutton. So he combined that idea of mutton dip and the sauces one might see in galbi or kalbi in Korean barbecue traditions, and you end up with something that is very much of the moment, that is an honest, to me, reflection of Kentucky and an honest interpretation by a man of Korean ancestry. For him to do that dish straight up, to me, would be dishonest. For him to cook a dish like that and say, this references mutton dip in Kentucky, this references the galbi of my Korean ancestry. That's an honest way of cooking, and to me is a great symbol of what Louisville looks like now and what Louisville will look like in the future. Edward told me in talking about this, he said, I'm very reserved about my Korean roots. I always know, though, when I get stuck in the Occidental world of cuisine, I have another vocabulary to pull from. And I think about that you know, He's assembled two vocabularies, and the Creole language that has emerged from the two is a quite honest reflection, I think, of 21st century Kentucky. Now, I told you I'd tell you two stories about Louisville that I think matter now and have resonance going forward. Make sure we're doing good on time. We should be great. We are. That second story, you probably know the details of better than Edward's life. I want to tell you a story of the Van Winkle family of Louisville. And, I'm based in Mississippi, but I travel around the country a good bit to eat and drink, and that's one of the pleasures of my job. And to get to say that, yeah, I eat and drink, and that, no, that's not an avocation, it's a vocation. It's good. But one of the things I see is that the most respected artisanal good in the whole of this nation right now, the most respected artisanal good is Pappy Van Winkle bourbon. Measured, sure, by price, but also measured by a genuine respect for the maker, Julian Van Winkle, and a genuine appreciation for the backstory that informs it. I was talking to the gentleman that interviewed me from the Louisville Courier-Journal. He asked me a question about the marketing of whiskey in Louisville. And he asked me a question to the effect, and I probably won't get this completely correct, but, you know, there seems to be a cynicism about marketing, you know, with people telling stories about a brand, conceiving backstories for a brand that aren't necessarily true. The good thing about the Van Winkle story is it is true. What sells their bourbon is the quality of their bourbon, but what also sells it is the family story. That has great resonance in this modern moment. And I think what the Van Winkles do is tell a story of Louisville, tell a story of their family, and they sell bourbon along the way. They use a model of scarcity, and scarcity sells, but they do it very well. So to close, and I'll step back up after the film, I want to show you a short film, The Southern Foodways Alliance, which I direct in collaboration with my friends at the Center for the Study of Southern Culture. We've made about 50 films over the last few years, each about kind of a tradition bearer in the South, someone who does something right. And it's almost an exercise in celebratory activism. Like, if you think the food world is going awry, let us tell you stories of things going right. And I think the Van Winkle story is one of those stories. So if I would quit talking so you could show the film, things would be good. So this is 13 minutes, and I'll step back up to take questions after. And I thank y'all for your attention.
I used to go duck hunting years ago in northeast Arkansas. And when Pappy, the 20-year-old, first came out, I would take it over there to share with these good old boys. And our guide would have his buddies come in the quack shack where we were staying. And they always had a 2-liter bottle of Diet Mountain Dew sitting around. They would drink with Crown Royal, or brown vodka, as we call it. And these old boys came in with their big cups, poured a little Pappy in there, and they reached for that 2-liter bottle of Diet Mountain Dew. I said, "You hold it right there, pal. That's as far as you're going with that bottle of whiskey. No Diet Mountain Dew in there, please." My grandfather, who was known as Pappy, started our family in the bourbon business in 1893. He was working for the W.L. Weller & Sons Wholesale Company. He was a character. There's only way to describe it. On the back label of our 20-year-old, you can see him playing golf with his hunting dog. His hunting dog's pulling his golf clubs. So that's the kind of guy he was. He loved to have fun. He loved the business. He was very important in the business. When he was alive, he was the oldest active distiller in the business. During Prohibition, he was one of the lucky distillers that was allowed. There were 5 or 6 of them that were allowed to make whiskey, medicinal whiskey, during Prohibition. So he was very lucky in that respect, because the Stitzel Distillery was allowed to produce whiskey during Prohibition. So they had stocks after Prohibition ended in 1933 and were allowed to continue in business, where hundreds of distilleries went out of business after Prohibition. But he made medicinal whiskey, so you go into the drugstore with your prescription from your doctor, and you're allowed to get a pint of whiskey, you know, 1 or 2 of them every 30 days. And it was strictly done through the druggist. And, you know, a lot of hurt fingernails back then, a lot of sore toes. I got to get a pint of whiskey. Pappy died in 65. The cigars and whiskey finally got the best of him at the age of 91, unfortunately. But Dad continued on. And in 1972, my dad was forced to sell the distillery. But when he did, he kept the old Rip Van Winkle label and started that brand with some bourbon he had made at Stitzel Weller. And it's the only thing he took with him, along with some stocks of bourbon he had made at Stitzel Weller, was that brand and label. In our case, we're using a wheated recipe, which means we're using corn and wheat and malted barley instead of corn and rye and malted barley. And we like to describe it as rye bread versus wheat bread. So as you know, rye bread tends to have a little bit of spice on the tongue, a little bit more zip to it on the back of the tongue, and wheat bread is softer, smoother, sweeter on the tongue. And that translates into whiskeys also. And that seems to be what has propelled our brand all over these years, was that same recipe we've been using for over 100 years. Kentucky's the perfect place to age bourbon, because it gets really hot in the summer and it can get very cold in the wintertime. So it expands into the wood when it's hot, and when it's cold, it expands back into itself. And this back and forth action all day long, all year long, is what's producing that color. It can happen at different temperatures in the warehouse, in different parts of the warehouse, depending on what the warehouse is made of, can really control the flavor of your whiskey, whether it be a hot whiskey or a smooth whiskey, or have a little bit more caramel, a little bit less caramel, and so forth. So that depends on your placing of the barrels in the warehouse, which is real important. We tended to put our barrels on the lower floors, the cooler floors, and the quicker aging bourbons they'll put on the top floor, and that will be a 3 or 4 year old whiskey. With the bourbon in the barrels for over 20 years, you really don't want to have it get too hot, you know, over the summer. So you want to keep them pretty cool, and it seems to work out very well. Some distilleries say that, well, you know, bourbon's not any good after 6 or 8 years old or whatever. Those distilleries don't have any older bourbon than that. That's why they say that, I believe, because we've kind of broken the mold as far as proving that bourbon can be very saleable at 15, 20, even 23 years old. We think our bourbon really at 10 years old is where you should start enjoying ours. Anything younger than that is going to be a little raw and not quite as nice. Each year that it spends in the barrel, it picks up more of the flavor of the resins in the barrel and the oak, and it changes every year that it's in there, coming a little bit smoother as it gets towards 20 years old, which I describe as a butter whiskey, really. It's so smooth, a lot of flavor, like a cognac, after-dinner cognac, but very soft on the tongue and sweet on the tongue. We taste every barrel that we bottle here, obviously, and we reduce them to 40 proof, because as you're tasting a number of barrels, you don't want your mouth to get burned out by 100 proof whiskey, so it's reduced down to about 40 proof with distilled water. And we just go through and taste every barrel, and we're looking for a certain flavor profile. We have a standard, which is the bottle that's already been bottled, and that's what we try and match with each barrel. So as we taste through these barrels, we're looking for something odd, something different that's not in the standard that we've been selling right along. So anything that's bad, we throw out, and they'll use that barrel for something else here at the distillery, but we don't want it in our product. That's a good one, too. There's no science to it. We had some 12-year-old whiskey, sold it under that Van Winkle Special Reserve label. It was a very simple label. Then I created the 15-year-old because I had some 15-year-old. The 20-year-old was something that I had available, and I wanted to honor my grandfather, Pappy, with a label in his honor. So found this picture of him smoking a cigar, lighting a cigar, and put it in the form of a label with an artist's help, and that's where that age came from. The 23-year-old, again, just had some 23-year-old bourbon that I had not sold at 20, and I wanted to put a really high-end product out there. It's like it's all happenstance, all just luck, but it was something that we hadn't sold at a younger age, so we just had excess whiskey and created another market for it, another label for it, to get rid of it. We're not selling vodka. We can't make it today and sell it tomorrow. We have to make a barrel of whiskey, and we can't touch it for 10 years. People don't realize that when they say, well, why don't you just make some more? And we get that quite a bit. Then I said, well, we don't just sell it, you know, make it today, sell it tomorrow. You have to think about this now. And they go, oh, yeah, you're right. You really can't just do that. So we're in the unfortunate situation where you have to sit on your product for a long time. Our business plan is 23 years long. So it's a little frustrating for those having to wait, and it's frustrating for us too, but we've been luckily making whiskey for years and putting it away for years. So down the road, our supplies will increase, but it's going to take a little while to get there. This is just selling bourbon whiskey, and you never want to make a ton of it. You can, but it's a lot more fun this way. We're selling what's in the bottle. We're not selling advertising. We're not selling labeling. It's what we've always done, the Van Winkle family has always done, is sell a very quality product. And it just so happens that other people seem to like it also. So I think that's why it's been successful. So I've always said, get it in their mouth, get it down their throat, and let them experience what it's like. And that's what's really sold our brand, is it tastes good, and they like it. But please don't mess it up with any soda. We've tried hard to get this stuff right. Don't mess it up when we drink it.
So as we close, you see the Southern Foodways Alliance website pop up there. So these films I mentioned, the 50-odd films we've made, oral histories we've collected, over 800. All of it's digitally accessible, free and open access. And I encourage you to go there and use those resources. We found a lot of success of late with professors using these in classrooms, with an urban agricultural group in Birmingham using these in teacher kits. So our belief is that by documenting the food culture of the American South, we're investing in the future of the American South. I thank you for listening to me tell you a story about your own place, and I hope I got at least some of that right. And I thank the Philson Historical Society for giving me this stage today. Thank you. Sure, and I'm happy to take a couple of questions. Yes, sir.
I have a theory about Southern food, Southern cooking, that I'd like to run by you.
Go for it.
It's just a general comment.
Yes, sir.
I went to school many years ago in New England and discovered in the back streets of Boston that cornbread of a very Southern
I think that's an accurate representation. There's a great essay written by a gentleman named John Thorne. He wrote an essay, it's been 15 or 20 years ago, called Cornbread Nation, and is about frontier America as Cornbread Nation, and that is the staff of life as, you know, as America came to the fore. And I think your observation is completely appropriate. And, you know, that idea I mentioned, too, about the pig being a very efficient converter of feed to flesh, free-ranging pigs scrambling about the southern countryside, you know, that was a norm in the South, and that kind of feeding was very much a frontier feeding. I would take your comments about something like cornbread and finding that in New England and extend it to think about the Great Migration, which took Southern food out of the South. You know, when I travel now, I still remember going to Chicago on a trip and seeing two different things that struck me so strongly. One was passing by a store and on the south side of Chicago, where a lot of African-American Southerners relocated. And the store was simply called the Mississippi Store. And I went in there, and I found products that I never saw in Mississippi, but were exported to Chicago with the idea this is what Mississippians wanted. And also on that same strip, I ended up at a restaurant not far from there. The name of the restaurant was Baby Jean's Yazoo Mississippi Style Soul Food. That attempt to replicate the South in the North. So, you know, to your earlier point, yes, I think, you know, a Southern diet looked like, you know, a Northern diet and a Southern diet had more in common in previous times. And I think there's also been a pollination of the North by Southerners who left the South when the getting was arguably good. Yes, sir.
Speaking of a great migration, would you comment on the influence of something like the Food Network?
Sure.
And it's, you know, thousands and thousands of hours about food and traditions and preparations. How does that roll into this migration of Southern cooking or import of others?
Well, I think the Food Network and the numerous shows on the Food Network that tell stories about the South have had a pretty profound effect. You know, for the longest time, we Southerners had a collective chip on our shoulder about many of our cultural products, whether it be art, whether it be music, whether it be food. And I think that kind of continuous feedback loop of Food Network has affected perhaps a younger generation than my own, but certainly, you know, my son's generation, to see Southern food showcased not always well and not always honestly, but that notion that Southern food had a place of national prominence. And I think we've certainly seen that over the last 5 to 10 years with the rise of Charleston as a great American restaurant town. I think, you know, if you talk to journalists now writing about food, you know, Charleston has almost, you know, gained the same stature as New Orleans in the national mind about where a great place to eat in America is. So I think the effect of media in general has instilled a sense of confidence and belief in Southerners that their food is worthy. And I think, you know, there are negative effects of the Food Network as well. You know, there's a stereotype of the South carried forward, an easy, facile, inappropriate, you know, an inaccurate stereotype of the South. But hey, it's TV. Yes, ma'am. Sure. And what was the second? Who was the
Casa Grisanti?
No, I don't. You need to educate me on Casa Grisanti. Okay, all right. So we'll return to Casa Grisanti, and come back to the first.
I was asking where Louisville ranks in your mind in terms of.
Sure. It's as if, I mentioned Charleston. It's as if it's Charleston's turn. And the kind of popular fascination with Charleston will wane. It really is probably already waning. So what's the next city from the South that will emerge? You know, I think Louisville has a lot of the, forgive me, ingredients to do that. I mean, that notion of, you know, great ham, great whiskey, you know, that kind of connoisseurship that Americans have developed for artisanal goods like the Van Winkles make. Kentucky offers a good bit of that for those who seek the next kind of citadel of American cuisine. You know, there are a number of other cities in the South that are ascendant in terms of food culture. Nashville, arguably, is the city following in behind Charleston now. And some of that is driven by a Charleston chef opening a restaurant in Nashville. That being Sean Brock of a restaurant called Husk and McCrady's in Charleston. My buzzer is going off. I should turn that off. My time is up. But I think that Nashville will be the next town, and I think Louisville has a really good shot of being the next town after that. You know, proximity, because so many writers are flying into Nashville to discover Nashville, tell stories about Nashville. You can watch the trends, and you can watch a lot of my friends who work in the media are really smart, but we're also pack animals. And the pack animals are descending on Nashville now, and I think there's a very good chance that the next place my pack arrives might well be Louisville. Yes, ma'am.
As you speak,
Sure.
When I first moved here in the 1960s, there was Cork and Cleaver, or that type of restaurant. There were no good restaurants. The good food
right.
was in private homes. There were country hams hanging in my mother's basement. The Grisani family opened something called Casa Grisani. It's long gone. Most of the wonderful restaurants here
sure.
have some connection with the Grisani family who opened that wonderful first restaurant. Kathy Carey opened Lepesh
sure.
probably 30 years ago. There was a pioneer in the form Farm to Table.
Agreed.
Susan Seiler continues to mm-hmm. reinvent herself.
Jack Frost, yeah.
And the rest of you can add your own favorites.
Sure.
She's what? Have some splendid people here and some amazing creativity up and down Main Street, Market Street, and throughout
sure.
the city. So you should stay a little longer.
Well, you forgive me for not knowing much about Grisanti's. I know a good deal about Kathy, and at our, I guess, the second symposium we ever staged, which would have been 16 years ago now, Kathy was the lead chef, and we've been friends for a long while. One of the really daunting things, and also one of the most gratifying things about writing and thinking about food culture, is, you know, that notion I mentioned ago that America hasn't taken food culture seriously because many of the people at the stove were black and there were women. And so there is much history to be recovered and rediscovered and celebrated. And that extends to restaurant history, too. There's much work to be done. And much of that knowledge resides in, you know, a room like this. But framing those stories and helping people understand that when you talk about farm-to-table connections, you know, it doesn't start with Alice Waters. She isn't the end-all and be-all. It includes people like Kathy Carey and Sarah Fritschner of the Courier-Journal, who was helping build that connectivity between farm and table early on, too. There's so many. So your point is very well taken, and to me that's the charge predominantly of the work of the Southern Foodways Alliance, is to tell those stories of those people who haven't gotten the recognition they deserve. Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
Why is sugar stealing into more and more recipes? In the newspaper, new recipes that have things that shouldn't have sugar in them, I think, have sugar now.
Right. So the pervasiveness of sugar in our diet?
Yes.
That's a vexing.
Bad stuff.
It is bad stuff. Well, moderation might make you think it's not so bad, but it's become the you know, it's really high fructose corn syrup that we've all isolated as the problem in our lives. High calorie counts is a problem in our life. Cheap processed foods is a problem in our lives. You know, that notion I talked about at the beginning of the talk, that food is this thing that delivers great enjoyment, it delivers sustenance, it powers our bodies, and yet the wrong kind of food is the kind of stuff that kills us. And that's what gives food a depth that not all the arts can claim, that life and death and pleasure, that notion that Lillian Smith talk about in Killer of the Dream, that you know, what enters or leaves our bodies is the basis of morality. Food has depth and meaning, and that notion of life and death and sugar and high fructose corn syrup, it's all wrapped up in it. Yes, ma'am. We would love to come back. She kindly asked when the Southern Foodways Alliance was going to come back to Kentucky. We would love to come back here and do more work. I mentioned we staged a summer symposium a few years back, and I hope we return in the near term. Pardon me, and there is also Lexington. Forgive me. One more. Okay, I'm getting the signal in the back that after y'all finish your fracas, I can take one more question, which I'm happy to do so. Yes, ma'am.
I would like for you to emphasize when you talk about bourbon and the bourbon barrels that the barrels can only be used once.
Right.
And therefore, bourbon barrel foods pick
Correct.
Up on that, which is a current reuse or repurposing.
Sure. It is. She mentioned the import of letting people know that, you know, that whiskey barrel, that bourbon barrel is only used once, and that realization is what drove a business like Bourbon Barrel Foods, Matt Jamie, you know, aging his soy sauce in bourbon barrels. You know, and it seems to me it's a far more honorable use than the planter on the side of your patio, which is the way I used to see bourbon barrels used. So It has. But those are really great products, and it's another one I see all across the nation is Matt Jamie's soy sauce. So thank y'all again very much.
All right, John Edge, thank you very much for an interesting look at our food ways and ourselves. We're going to take a 45-minute break.